You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. I'm your host, Bill Kite, and today our guest is Genevieve Villamizar, who has been on the show before. So welcome again and welcome back.
Hi, Bill.
How are you today?
I'm tired.
Okay. Well, this won't be so bad. It won't take so long, so we'll get started here. You've told me before, and I know you're an instructor at CMC, you've told me before that your love for nature and landscaping goes back to when you were at school at Colorado State University at CSU. How did that happen?
I think like anyone who's climbing and backpacking and spending all of your free time outside, your eyes start to open, you know. And I had come from everywhere else but Colorado, beautiful green places. And getting used to a rocky, brown, gravelly landscape was a several-year process. And as I started reading more Western writers and traveling around the different parts of Colorado and Utah and the desert, it started to speak to me more. And I had to lose my infatuation with green to finally appreciate what Colorado actually is. And while all that was happening, the Front Range was going through a series of two really significant droughts. And there was also a renaissance in Western horticulture, where the Denver Botanic Gardens and Colorado State University, which is a research university, they were starting to promote the Western aesthetic in landscape and horticulture as well. And I got exposed to all kinds of new and, to me, beautiful and exotic things. So it was just like having new toys in my toy box or new paints and colors in my paint palette.
So the landscape can be read, it can be listened to, can it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you talked about drought, and how do you think the drought that we are experiencing now, and it's obviously another period of not enough snow, how it's going to affect homeowners this summer, and what can they do to conserve our Crystal River water and nurture their landscape at the same time?
Well, I think that we need to let go of our old habits of, you know, something as simple as irrigation. The native landscape doesn't like being dribbled on all the time. It's basically growing something hydroponically, and its roots are shallow. It doesn't have any resilience or vigor the way most people water things. If you really want to keep the fish happy and keep water in the rivers, the better thing to do is to think of the monsoons, where it's infrequent, but it's a long, slow, heavy drench where the water can go down really deep. And as we look at what's coming this summer, not to be alarmist, but we have some habits that we need to look at and address and change. So, yeah.
So what specifically can people do to decrease their usage of water?
Well, if you don't understand your irrigation clock, then pay the $40 or $50 to have somebody come to your house and adjust your irrigation clock so that instead of watering 3 or 4 days a week for 15 or 20 minutes, which again keeps all the roots on the surface of the ground, you know, within the top 2 to 3 inches, have them adjust it so that maybe it pours an inch of water every 7 to 10 days. It'll take a couple of weeks for your plants to get used to that, and things might look a little bit more faded than normal, but you're actually working on the roots at this point, not the top, and you're encouraging deeper roots that can consume a larger volume of water at once and create a more resilient plant. And for the fish and the waters and the streams and the riparian areas and all of the other creatures that need the water in our river, I think that $50 is pretty worth it.
Sounds like good advice. One of your CMC classes is April 23rd from 6 to 8 p.m. in Carbondale, and it's entitled The Lawnless Yard. Tell me a little bit about what a yard, a, large, lawnless yard is. Why forego a lawn?
Not everybody uses it. You know, I mean, if you have kids or if you like to sit on your furniture in the middle of the lawn, look at how much of it's actually used. And any of it that you don't use, what's off in the corners, or if you only use maybe a 15-foot diameter square, just get rid of the rest and do something else there. It saves water. It saves the maintenance of all the time that you spend mowing and weed whacking and irrigating. And if some of you are not true Bondalians at heart, getting rid of your dandelions. So it's just about balance and finding the right balance for living in a semi-arid climate and simplifying your own lifestyle. I'd rather go running than mow my yard.
Oh, I hated when I had a yard. That was my least favorite thing to do, was to have to mow the lawn. So I understand that one completely. That's why it attracted me. Lawnless yard. I like that.
Thank you.
Knowing you and talking to you a lot, I know you use the word native. Most people think of a mess when they think of native landscapes. So how does design help to navigate that, and how can a person replicate what they see in nature and be successful?
Design is just putting an organizing hand to a landscape that you might create out of natives. Our natives have a character that reflects the spirit of the West, and it tends to be scrappier. A lot of it is more herbaceous. They have different characteristics that help them adapt to our really bright, intense, high altitude sun and the intermittent rains. And some people are not very fond of that aesthetic. However, there are plants that you can use that are native, that are soft and green and beautiful and attractive. And when you apply traditional design, design theories and design practices to how you put your yard together or how you renovate your yard, it will look just as beautiful, whether it's native or a bunch of ornamental exotics from California or Florida or, you know, that tend to live here. But it will be a landscape that has soul, you know, that reflects what we see and appreciate around us. As for the other part, how do you bring those vignettes that you see on your biking trips or your camping trips or whatever, how do you bring that into your own backyard? That is somewhat individual, but you can take cues from nature. For example, let's say you see this really amazing, beautiful pinyon pine, and it has a skirt of rabbit brush around it. That's only two species, and those two things together often stop people in their tracks. You know, it's beautiful, it's breathtaking. When you're out there running or biking or backpacking or climbing or just being in the mountains, look around for those small little snapshots and look at the plants and the structure that's in that photograph that you take, whether it's in your mind or on your iPhone, and replicate that in your own property. It's actually pretty basic.
It is, isn't it? People like to think that, basic, they like to get beyond basic, get too complicated, but it pays to keep things simple, doesn't it?
Yeah,
sometimes?
Sure does. It's very peaceful.
What will your Rocky Mountain Plants class on October? Boy, that's a word that come from. On April the 30th, what will it encompass? And I guess, why is a Rocky Mountain native plant, a regionally adapted plant, more likely to survive here? I know the answer, but I think a lot of other people probably don't.
Well, Rocky Mountain Plant Class is going to go through kind of like a toolbox of trees and shrubs, grasses and perennials that thrive in this area. As a design professional and a gardener at heart, I see so many people spending a lot of money on things that are not going to thrive. And I know, as expensive as it is, it's probably pretty disheartening for people to spend that much money and just see something struggle summer after summer. There are, just like there are climbers that go around the world seeking out really cool remote crags, there are a bunch of plant geeks in Colorado. Some of them are very dear friends of mine that have been doing this for 20 or 30 years, and they travel around the world too, you know, along this same parallel to similar landscapes, steppe landscapes and semi-arid landscapes. And they bring back some really amazing plants. And those plants, because they're in a place similar to ours, they really hold the spirit of this landscape. And why would you want to use something that's so common and ordinary that says Connecticut or Kansas when it could say South Africa or Mongolian desert or the cliff sides of Spain in a Rocky Mountain way? So the Rocky Mountain Plants class is going to introduce people through descriptions in conversation. And anyone who knows me knows that I have very colorful opinions of everything. So I'll make it an interesting class, and I definitely bet you're going to laugh. But you also walk away with a bunch of really cool plants that I definitely know you're going to want to stick in your landscape.
So before people just run out into the woods and the desert and start plucking up plants, there are places you need permits to do that, aren't there? I mean, you know, like the Forest Service and BLM, you need permits to
remove. Yeah, well, I wouldn't even recommend going out and try to harvest plants from the wild. A sagebrush, for example, that might be 6 inches tall might also be 8 years old. And it could have a root that's as thick as your ankle 2 feet down, you know. So right. If you're trying to dig up a baby plant and bring it into your yard, you're going to be losing the most important part of it, which is that root system that's mining through all that crazy rock and hard dirt to get the water and the resources that it needs. And more than likely, it's going to die. So I don't even recommend it.
So where can people get the seeds or the plants that they need locally?
Well, you can get a foraging permit for seeds, but I doubt anyone here has the motivation right. or patience for that.
That's hard. I've done that before. That's really hard.
My favorite place to get plants locally is Eagle Crest, frankly, because I love Diane and George and everybody that works over there, and they have an amazing plant selection. And no, I've never worked for Eagle Crest, and I'm not promoting them directly.
Right.
I just love them. But I also like going on buying trips on the Front Range because that's like going to Paris to buy fashion or something like that.
It's just exciting. You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Show for Land's Sake. We have aspen and we have spruce here in the valley. What qualities, I know blue spruce, people like to plant those. What qualities make them desirable, and what does their future look like for us?
This is a touchy subject for me.
Well, give it a shot.
I love the spruce. They are so beautiful. But their day has come and gone for planting spruces on the valley floor. There's this beautiful new house that was built in a certain part of town that I won't give too many details about. And it breaks my heart to see that their entire berm is planted in spruce. And if you think about where spruce like to live and where aspen like to live, one, they live at a higher elevation, which means that they're dormant for a longer part of the year and they have shorter summers. The other thing about spruce and aspen is for the most part, they're riparian plants. They like to be on the east and the north sides of things where they have nice, cool, damp roots in delicious soil, you know, and that is not what we have here in our home landscapes. And the aspen as well, they like to have those shorter summers. And yes, there are beautiful, humongous spruces in our landscape right now, but those were planted 20, 30 years ago. And our climate is hotter and drier. And if you're really in love with those, there are things that you can do to have that spirit in your yard or on your property. But I wouldn't go for the big trees. I would look at dwarf cultivars for spruces. Some spruces can grow only as tall as 6 feet, and they're just darling, and they make the perfect outdoor Christmas tree. And some can grow to 15 feet. There are baby blue eyes, there are R.H. Montgomery's, there are cultivars that you can buy that are scaled for the yard. And because it's smaller, it has more of a likelihood of succeeding down here on the valley floor. How can you sneak aspens in? Any tree will live for 2 or 3 years because of the fertilizers in the soil and because of the dormant buds that they have that are preparing for the next year. But after that initial push, you'll start to see decline. I get a lot of clients that are asking me for aspens, and I talk to them about why, and they still insist on it. So when they do insist, I tell them to put it on the east or the north side and in really rich soil. But what works best if you really want that aspen feel is plant them in really big pots and have them on your patio where you know that it has a limited lifespan and you're going to let it go.
What is the limited lifespan of aspen? About 80, 90 years for in the forest? Was it the same here in, if you plant them in town?
I don't know about 80 or 90 years. I would think so because if you look at like the Spanish shepherds carvings on them and
right.
stuff, those are from, you know, generations ago. You're not going to see that in the landscape here. I mean, if you just open up your eyes and look around right now, you can see all the dead branches and aspen trees and all the oozing black weeping sores on the
sides. I was going to ask you, what is that? Because you see that in a lot of aspen.
That is just the manifestation of the stress, the tree being susceptible to borers and to molds and funguses because they're not freaking happy. For lack of a better way.
There you go. You need happy trees if you're going to plant trees, don't you? So what qualities that people see, the aesthetic qualities in aspen and in spruce, what are some substitutes that they might be able to
first of all, just start dwarf, because the straight species of anything are pretty much too big for our yard anyway. And like I said, there's the blue star spruce and there's the Baker spruce and the hoop spruce and the Montgomery spruce. These all grow in, they will only mature to a specific width. For example, an R.H. Montgomery will be no more than 4 feet wide, ever. Even when it's 60 years old, it'll be 4 feet wide and maybe 6 to 8 feet tall. And that's pretty cute. I mean, that's a really powerful designing tool to know that that is what its mature size is going to be. If you look at a lot of spruce trees in front yards, it covers half of the house.
Well, yeah, and people plant those trees when they're little and they
and
plant
they
them too
so
close.
Cute.
They look cute and they're so close together. Then when they mature, it's just they're against each other or the house and they didn't realize how big they were going to get.
And an evergreen that size, especially something that has the nature of a spruce, which is really pokey and painful and it will give you rashes on your arms, you know, when you mess around with it. That evergreens that big, they have to me what I call like a black hole energy to it. Nothing lives under it. It looks exactly the same all year long. It just never changes except growing bigger. I like things that show that, you know, they dance with the sunlight. They change with the seasons. They change color. Or, for example, small fir trees, they get those beautiful chartreuse buds, you know, at the tips of the new branches. And also, again, starting smaller. So, yeah. And as for substitutes for aspen, there's no substitute.
There isn't, is there?
I mean, let's
just
admit it.
Yeah,
that's
true. There's
just magic.
So for people that want, I can never say this, Xeriscape?
Xeriscape. X-E-R-I. Not zero, but zero.
Xeriscape. Yeah. So if people want that kind of a yard, is that fairly easy to put in, or does it take some thought and some real planning?
Well, any landscape takes thought and planning. And a lot of people have negative connotations around xeriscape, but a xeriscape just means that you're using plants that can survive off of the water of the local environment. That's all that it means. So a xeriscape here is different from a xeriscape in Arizona, is different from California. It's a smarter way of saying it would be a really well-designed water-wise landscape using primarily natives with a few exotics closer around the house.
I can pronounce water wise. Sounds better. I like that. You say you want to be outside playing. You're an outdoors person like I am, and not weeding and gardening. Mm-hmm. So what are your own landscape goals these days?
I think that they're probably pretty much like anyone else's. Where I rent. I don't own my own home. Someday that'll change. And when I do. You know, obviously, as a landscape designer and having been studying this stuff and implementing this stuff for over 20 years, I have some really solid ideas about how I would do this for myself. And looking realistically at the lifestyle that I want for my home and for my family, it'll primarily be permeable hardscaping. So patio surfaces where the water can still permeate down into the ground. And that hardscaping will basically just, it'll be my outside nest. The decks and the patios and the walkways will all support the flow of the life of how I want to live outside. And as you know, I like to entertain. I like to barbecue. I like to have 10, 15 friends over. And I never have enough space for that to do it comfortably. So my future, it will be about outdoor dining and large patio spaces, and then with holding space around it, and it will probably be trees and shrubs and grasses. I'm going to forget the foo-foo stuff. I'm not going to waste my time having beautiful flower borders and all that. I'm going to recreate my own tiny little piece of nature that caters to birds and squirrels and butterflies and bees and chickens and the deer and all of that stuff and little kids.
All right. You have a class that's going on right now called Outdoor Living Made Real on Tuesdays. What's that about?
We canceled that class this year.
Oh, okay.
I will be doing it again in the fall. But basically, it's just a class that teaches people pretty much about how to create that flow that I just mentioned for my own property that I dream about, how to create that for themselves. And it's pretty cool. My favorite students are the husbands and wives. You always wind up being somewhat of a therapist and, you know, helping them find balance in the middle. And in the past, it's been really fun because the students and I, we have the ability to make agreements around this. And the last two classes that I've had, rather than do it in class, we wrap up the class by me visiting their property and looking at the designs that they've developed and helping them finish out those last final details. And it's been really cool. There's a student of mine who lives right down the street from me, and every single time I see her, she gets excited and she takes out her phone to show me pictures of the backyard that they've transformed from taking that class. And it's super cool. I mean, to actually see somebody get out there and make that change and do that design, and their yard looked, insert a swear word here, their yard looked horrible before and they could never use it for anything. And now it's super cool. They have friends over, their dog has grass, they have bocce ball, everything's organized, they've got the fruit trees they wanted. And instead of just being this flat, blank, gravelly area, they divided it into two separate levels. So their whole backyard has this whole like dynamic quality to it. It's pretty cool.
So if people want to take that class, then they can take it this fall then,
yes,
if they missed
it the
first time. Okay. I know you're kind of a natural teacher. And so what are some of the pleasures you've seen in teaching at CMC?
I love seeing that shift where they, all of a sudden, they get it. And next thing you know, I'm loaning them my books and I'm sending them links online, and they just get really captivated by when you have a mess, and you have a mess that you've inherited from the two or three families that own the house before you, it's kind of hard to know where to start. And I always start out with the editing process. And when these students get some courage and they start whacking down trees and ripping out bushes, it's kind of like what a meditation practice does. You know, you open up space, and in that opening of space, all of a sudden there's possibility. And when I see that happen for my students.
Right.
Yeah.
So, the name of your company is, you have a name for it. Salt and Dirt.
Salt and Dirt Outside Design. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So your title here that I'm looking at is Envision Your Outdoor Dream Space. So sometimes people may not know what they really want, mm-hmm, until they start kind of digging into the dirt. And mm-hmm, so how do you help them to get that vision?
Probably at midpoint in that class, I will do like a 40-minute slideshow from all of these different idea books that I've assembled on Howes, because it's not Facebook. What's the other one that everybody's addicted to? That's all pictures.
Instagram.
Instagram. Yeah. God, I sound old. I should know that.
Okay.
So Howz is my Instagram, and I all create right. all of these different idea books based on different themes, and we break down the different elements of what the landscape is, and when the students are immersed in image after image after image, that can't help but sink in, and they start to be able to see what they want in those pictures. And we have a great big 2-foot by 3-foot map for each person's property, and some people even laminate it and use dry erase, and people just go crazy, you know, designing and dreaming.
Well, I should certainly enjoyed talking with you again today, Genevieve, and if you've been listening to KDNK's For Land's Sake, until next time, April the 10th at 4:30, this is your host, Bill Kite, asking whatever you do to Mother Earth, do it for land's sake.